Hi, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, we Zoom the day before, so if something should happen, but at least we know who the Biden VP pick is. So that's the conversation anyway that's going on, not only in the United States, but across the world. We Zoom on Wednesday. As we begin every show, as we've done for months now, we begin with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I need to make sure that you remember his voice as you exercise the franchise in 2020. It is both a powerful voice, it's a voice of commitment to country, not to an elected leader, and it's the voice of what a patriot looks like, and it's also why immigration policy is so important, because he is from a family of immigrants. They fled, they came here, and look what their son accomplished. And frankly, he didn't just offer leadership to the United States, he's offered leadership to the world. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
It's Thursday, and normally he hangs out with us on Friday, but hey, you know, I'll take him anytime. Bill Curry joins us. Bill Curry is a former two-time nominee for governor in the great state of Connecticut. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He writes for Salon.com. He's a progressive leader. He's the person that I get more emails every time he comes on the air, so I know if nothing else, I got to keep him on just because I want those emails to keep coming. There's so much to talk about, Bill. You made a comment this morning before you came on the air about Kamala Harris. Both of us were looking for someone else. Both of us are not surprised that Joe Biden picked Kamala Harris. What you said actually reflected my sentiments. I was like, okay, last night. And then this morning I woke up and I went, wow, this isn't so bad. Actually, I'm okay about this. Let's talk a little bit about Kamala and how even you and I are evolving on what we knew was a predictable choice. This is not a shock to anyone. But at the same time, it seems to be sitting better the next day, which is a good sign for Joe Biden and a good sign for the Democratic Party.
I think that's right. I'll just say flat out, this was not far from my first choice, and in some ways my last choice, and I'll explain why that is. But it's also a reminder when you look at the nature of the choice. Am I any less excited today about electing Joe Biden and defeating the fascist Donald Trump? Nope. No, I'm not. I'm just as hepped up today as I was yesterday afternoon. And I do think that this is a woman with extraordinary political skills. Her skill set is first rate. And so that's going to be there. It's a campaign. It's an election. So having a really good political skill set is not a bad attribute. I think that progressives are disappointed today in this choice. I don't have any doubt about that at all. It's hard on a day when so many women and women of color are celebrating and feeling really good about something for, you know, a rump faction of we progressives to not be part of that party. It feels a little off to have those feelings. And I think some progressives woke up with that this morning. But, you know, I also think that this just sets a tone. Remember, I still believe this after a lifetime of being involved in one progressive cause after another. I look at this platform at 86 pages. It's twice the length of the last platform and longer than any of my life. It has more detail, more content. It is as progressive as any platform. It ties the 2008 platform as the most progressive Democratic Party platform of my lifetime. And the main question is whether they mean it. Okay. And in 2008, Obama put a lot of things in that platform that he didn't really think. And I think the end result of that was Trump. I think the end result of our not following through on the promises of political reform and economic justice and middle-class prosperity and security, I think the end result of that was Trump.
Yeah.
And so I look at this and I see that we need change. But I think two things. There's a tremendous natural, wide, forget progressives, centrists, establishment, forget all of that. The consensus of the American people, the 60% plus consensus of the American people to clean up politics, fight climate change, set a living wage, expand health care, make higher education affordable. The consensus has never been so strong and so broad in the country. The consensus within the party, our differences have never been so small. I said in an earlier show, when this Democratic Party was comprised of Northern liberals and Southern racist segregationists, we still got the New Deal done. And it hadn't changed much by the 1960s, and we got the Great Society done. The differences of this Democratic Party compared to the Democratic Party at any point in its history are de minimis.
Yes.
And the party is more aligned with the larger public on more issues than it's been since I registered to vote, which was 100 years ago. And so those things make me very optimistic. If Biden is a somewhat mediocre candidate and his pick doesn't send chills up and down progressive spines, this is a moment in our history that we can grasp, and we should be really excited about that.
So let me share two things. Why I felt better in the morning. Who is Kamala Harris? Mother from India, father from Jamaica. She's the epitome of America. She is the immigrant's story. She is the story of coming here. She is the story of coming here for opportunity. She is the story about an opening and welcoming country, not a country that's shutting down asylum seekers and refugees and people coming across the border and they can't figure out immigration policy. So there's a piece of her that is just so remarkable. Then I'm going to do something very personal here. So she grew up in this sort of very sort of San Francisco, sort of more sort of erudite wealthy community. Why did she go to Howard? And let me tell you why I think she went to Howard. And you're going to be sort of somewhat surprised by this. I relate to that. I grew up in a Jewish-Italian neighborhood on Long Island. I was not Jewish. I'm half Italian and half Norwegian. All my peers and all my friends and all my parents' friends were basically Jewish. I grew up, you know, there were the tracking system and whatever. And my mother kind of wanted to avoid her Italian heritage. You know, my mother was so funny about that. So she really sort of embraced the community and especially the Jewish community. Well, here was the problem. I wasn't Jewish. I was never dateable. I was even told that by mothers, okay? I always felt like I didn't go to Hebrew school and everybody else went to Hebrew school. I always felt like I was like a fish out of water. I had no place. I had no home. And I would run away every summer. So where did I end up going to school? St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. I thought that maybe what I could do is find my other half of my ethnicity, something that I had never really seen where I was growing up, something I didn't really understand, but that I knew I was also half Norwegian. So I went to St. Olaf in part to experience a little bit about who I was, okay? And I look at her making the decision to go to Howard as finding about her experience. Who am I? You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, being a dark-haired Norwegian and nobody knows that, and it's much easier to sort of be aware in any community that you are a person of color because you wear it, okay? But I thought it was so interesting that she went to Howard because I could relate to it, because in a lot of ways, part of the reason I went to St. Olaf was I wanted an experience that reflected a little bit about who I was. And so I kind of look at her arc, and I think if you care about immigration policy in the United States, this is a celebration. If you care about the fact that we are this remarkable melting pot, this is a celebration. There's a part of me that is actually very hopeful. And yeah, she's not what I want from a policy perspective, but you know what, Bill? That's my job. My job as a progressive, my job as looking at Congress and getting people elected is to make sure people that sort of dream what I think the American people really want and will fight for it are going to be in Congress. And as a result, it's going to sort of change the conversation and move it even more so we can deliver on that promise Barack Obama made in 2008, never delivered, but maybe we can finally start delivering it after the 2020 election.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that's basically right. I'm a little more skeptical of the politics of biography, as David Axelrod called it, and the comfort that I can take from it. I want people who look like the people who need our help. but mostly I want people who will help the people who need our help. That requires a commitment to fundamental change in the country that most Democrats at the top don't have. But that's the way it's been. You know, the Democratic Party in its glory days really was a tribune for the disadvantaged and the marginalized, and certainly for the excluded. With all its warts and blemishes, it would pull itself together in key moments and deliver, mostly because it was being flogged by its base, but sometimes because of its own higher ideals. We're coming to this moment, again, I talked about the New Deal and the Great Society. The Great Society was 50 years ago. It's been a half century since we've had a really productive legislative session in the United States, of the United States Congress. It really has. It's been half a century. Yeah. It's the longest we've ever gone between reforms. The populists, the progressives, the New Dealers, the Great Society, these things all came every 10, 20 years. It's been 50. It's never taken this long to put reform back in the saddle in the history of our country.
Wow.
Or even remotely so.
We actually had deform when we elected Bill Clinton.
Yes. Well,
instead of reform, we had deform, as far as I'm concerned, but that's another story.
There's no question, no question about it. And so we have this opportunity coming up for all the reasons we spoke about before. In the debate we're about to have, the things we have to watch out for, and I still talk to progressives as recently as this morning, who talk about continuing to put pressure on the Biden ticket and on the convention and on the Democratic Party. It's like, to me, I don't want to do that now. I just want to be a good soldier. There's 100 days, 90 days left now. I just want to make sure, I've said many times when Trump's first announcement, when you see fascism, your first job is to kill it in its crib. We didn't do that. And so we have one last chance now to do that. Do not for a moment underestimate the price we will pay if we fail. Climate change and the democracy being the first two casualties. So this is all there. And so I look forward to the next, not just the next few months in winning this thing and pulling this thing out, and then to the argument that follows. And I would just say, we're about to have a Democratic Party within which the entire useful political debate in America will transpire. The coming American political debate is strictly intramural.
Yes.
It will go on among the factions of the Democratic Party, one, because the Republicans are so extreme, two, because they're so partisan they won't cooperate anyway, and three, because the agenda demands it. We have to do things about climate change and corruption and middle-class security and prosperity and racial justice that they would dream of doing. When I worry about Biden, and to a lesser degree, he still talks so much about bipartisanship. I would love to get that clear. I always have made it a point in my life to listen to Republican voters, to try to learn from people who are more conservative than I am. And they will have points. How much does a program cost? How well does it work? How much of an overreach into our private lives, for the old line conservatives at least, does a government policy represent? Those are still discussions worth having, but not with elected Republicans who have been fascist or borderline fascist in the United States Congress for the first time in our history for a number of years now. We talked a little bit before about the QAnon movement, which is taking over that party as surely as the Tea Party did. They've won three big primaries, two U.S. House and a U.S. Senate primary, going away. It wasn't even close. It wasn't microscopic turnout. It wasn't only one candidate in the field. In multiple candidate contests, the QAnon candidate ran away with the game. For people who don't know QAnon, I know most people by now do, it's the anti-Semitic, daft, crazy, loco, conspiracy-mongering theory, which, oddly enough, is spread by apparently a founder who himself remains a mystery. The greatest mystery in QAnon is itself. But they're the people who said that Hillary Clinton was running a pedophile sexual trafficking ring in a pizza place at the Comet Ping Pong Pizza in Washington, which they nearly drove out of business. They said it was all going out in the cellar. They didn't have a cellar. I mean, it was just outrageous. The Republican Party is either supportive or silent, and the Republican base is actually voting for this. They get up and they call the squad extreme while they are nurturing the most extreme fascist, conspiracy-mongering, anti-Semitic movement seen in this country since the Klan at its height. That's just how it is right now.
Right.
That's where we are.
I'm seeing a Lincoln Project ad that basically sort of replicates everything you just said on this radio show, because I think people need to be sort of slapped around a little bit to understand this is not a party. This is not a Republican Party. This is not the GOP. I mean, it has that label and it has that name and they're running under that. But when you begin to look at what Donald Trump has done, what he's done to sort of undermine the executive branch, the kind of people that he's attracted, the fact that those folks won, and as you point out, with more than 50% of the vote in a multi-candidate primary.
Those are huge victories.
That's a big win. but it just shows not only about what is rotted out of the Republican Party, but what decides to, you know, basically participate in a primary and embrace it. Three is a lot of candidates, everyone. I mean, how big is the squad? Four. I want people to understand. You just mentioned three. How big is the squad? Four. And here's the sad part. You've got three that just won, and you got the guy sitting in the corner office.
And when the squad asked for something so terribly radical as a Green New Deal, Nancy Pelosi raps them on their knuckles, okay? And when QAnon spews out venomous anti-Semitic conspiracies, Donald Trump retweets them, okay?
Their
whole party has caught this contagion now. Whole party has. And so it tells us a couple of things. One, it tells me that, I would have, there are a couple of names that would occurred to me before Kamala Harris's name for VP, but I ain't letting go, And I'm willing to see the many positives about her candidacy. I see that it's energizing people. I'm thrilled with that. I am thrilled to see this kind of diversity at the very top. It also reminds me that this intramural debate within the Democratic Party is America's debate now. And among my worries about a Biden administration, for all the hope I just described and the high expectations I have, should we win this, one, I hope, looking at the state of the Republican Party, looking at QAnon and looking at all of it, that we don't begin an attempt to reach out to the Republicans to try to govern in some bipartisan way. When Biden talks like this, I think he slept through his entire vice presidency. This is already a strategy that really, really hurt Obama and Biden in the 8 years they had. I hope we're done with it. And the second thing is something I've also talked about before, not in a while, but we need to commit to looking into having genuine public commissions that examine the criminality of the last 4 years, that examine the criminality that goes on in much of, frankly, our private sector at the highest levels of corporate power. We didn't go after the Wall Street culprits in the way that 2008 platform promised we would. We never did an Iraq commission like the British did. We have grown as a country unwilling to look at ourselves in the mirror or to look at our own recent past to see how to make our future. And the Democratic Party, there are four things that are just on my mind. One is, forget the bipartisanship rap. Just promise civility and logic and reason.
Thank you.
Do not, in the name of national unity, step away from the kinds of truth and reconciliation commissions that are desperately needed. And then the two topic areas are corruption. The Democratic Party, I do not believe that Biden and Harris are the two best people to pursue an anti-corruption agenda, nor do I believe that Pelosi and Schumer are. We have to understand as progressives that the corruption is one of the two issues along with climate change that we have to keep forcing to the center of the debate. And then the last thing is foreign policy. Biden's no Hillary Clinton. He's a much better on foreign policy in terms of when to intervene and how much to use the military and when to try to use soft power. He's a big, big improvement there. But he ain't God's gift to world peace either in terms of the stuff that he brings from this bipartisan consensus of the 40 years prior to Trump, 50 years. And we need fundamental changes in national security and foreign policy. We need to renounce the utilization of violence as a means of resolving human conflict in this world. That's our goal. We have to start to get there. We have to say it openly. We need to embrace multilateralism for conflict resolution, which is what that means. We need to expose all the weaknesses of our previous foreign policy doctrines in order to move this country into the one place of safety where it can be. The only thing that really protects America is the rule of law and our ability to promote it on a global basis. And you start by embracing it yourself.
Let me just say a couple of things. As you were talking about that you hope that they go in and they look at the corruption, they look at our history and they expose this and they do. Do you know who should embrace that more than any other group? Black Lives Matter. Because really the story of Black Lives Matter is a story
That's a really good point.
We haven't acknowledged our history. We haven't acknowledged how the corruption has hurt them. we haven't been willing to sort of understand, I love that book, The Color of Law, what we did legally to basically undermine the ability of the African-American community to succeed in America, and we did it with policy. So in an interesting way, as you're talking about, and again, 2008, who was the most devastated by the 2008 economic downturn? It was the African-American community. They were finally owning homes. They were finally, you know, we able to, you know, sort of get that mortgage, and they found out that it was a liar loan or was whatever. And they have not really come back from that 2008. So in an interesting way, your point about corruption should be armed with the Black Lives Matter and say, this matters. This matters. This is when you don't face your failure, you don't look at your history, you don't address corruption, this is what you get. You get, basically, you get this chaos in the streets, you get, you know, the police that you want to defund, you get an America that's so racist and segregated you can't imagine. And I think if you make that connection, Bill, write the piece for Salon, write the piece for whomever, but make that connection, because that's what happens when you fail to look back and acknowledge the mistakes of the past. Not only do you not educate the public about them, but you don't have the license to make change.
I agree wholeheartedly with that. I'd like to add one piece to it, and that is that the things that help people of color the most in this country and that are highly obtainable in this moment help everyone. These are universal reforms. No one profits more from universal health care or living wage than do women of color. That's who gets the most out of it from the get-go.
Right.
And there is an agenda that unites us. I am still, in that sense, old school. I want everybody on the same bus, heading for the same destination. There are debates within our party about reaching out to white working class voters. It doesn't mean pandering to their fears. It means including them into an agenda that helps them understand that we are already all on the same bus.
Right.
We're just not going anywhere nice, you know? And so we just have to really stop for a moment. And I think of Dr. King in his last years trying to translate the civil rights agenda to an economic agenda, to a broader agenda. That was his instinct. That was the instinct of Malcolm X at the end of his career. It was the instinct of so many people whom I profoundly admire. And I do believe, I don't want the white working class to drift off into QAnon land.
No.
I don't want to lose them. There are millions of them that we can bring back into a majoritarian consensus.
Yeah.
And the way we do that is by doubling down on our commitments to political reform and economic justice.
Yep.
And that's what brings everybody together in the way you want. We'll be in great shape in November and even better shape thereafter.
So I'm going to end this conversation by reminding my audience that in 1984, I went to hear Shirley Chisholm speak in Concord, New Hampshire. She's speaking to a bunch of poverty workers. I was a poverty worker. She changed my life. She told me that if I wanted to help, I needed to get political. I needed to run the risk of running for election. And she talked about this. Remember, this is this Black former congresswoman who ran for president of the United States comes to this room of 400 white women. That's what it was. And her message was so powerful because it was just like you. We're on the same bus. Now let's get the bus going. Let's go in the right direction. She said it to me in 1984. She changed my life. Bill Curry, I wish that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris hear you, because this is our opportunity. You're not asking them to be radical. You're asking them to respond to what America needs and needs now. Bill Curry joins us every other week. I'm so glad he's with us. Former Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut, advisor to Bill Clinton, and a great progressive voice, and a writer at Salon.com. We will talk again soon. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Stick around, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back.
Good fences make good water. On this current cast. Cows wading in a stream might make a pretty picture, but the reality is a lot less pleasant. Jean Can is a microbiologist with Stroud Research Center. He's been monitoring streams in the Delaware River watershed for bacteria that are present as a result of fecal contamination. And he's found high levels, especially in summer.
We try to understand why we have that high number of bacteria and how can we reduce those bacteria.
Ken says possible causes include leaky septic systems and runoff from nearby farm fields. But wading cows also contribute by excreting waste directly in the water. So he says fencing livestock out of streams can help protect water quality. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1892. That was the day miners in Tracy City, Tennessee, rebelled against the state's convict lease system. Miners had been forced to work side by side with convict labor. The convicts, overwhelmingly African American, were forced to live in deplorable stockade conditions. Their presence in the mines served to minimize paid labor, keep wages low, and stunt union organizing throughout the state. Miners demanded that Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad give them the same hours of work as the convicts. When they refused, the miners marched on the stockades where the convicts were housed. They released the convicts and marched them onto trains bound for Nashville, burning the stockades to the ground. The revolt at Tracy City followed armed uprisings of thousands of miners the previous year in nearby Briceville and Coal Creek. Here, it is thought that the Knights of Labor leaders led miners to surround stockades, disarm guards, and release convicts onto Knoxville-bound trains over the course of several days. By August of 1892, hundreds of miners would confront state forces in armed shootouts across Grundy, Marion, and Anderson counties, releasing convicts when they could onto trains bound for Nashville. Miners were eventually arrested and convicted, but these revolts would lead the Tennessee General Assembly to end its convict lease system 4 years later, making them one of the first southern states to do so.
Well, they brought in the entire state militia, heavy artillery and Gatling guns.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The newspaper said they won a great victory, handed out medals for their bravery. They got the convicts out of the mines. I've been traveling all night long, and I've been dreaming of this song, and I've been wishing on a star, and I can't believe I've gotten this far. I got no ticket, cause wherever I am is home. No, I got no ticket, cause wherever I am is home. I've been running from my past, but nobody told me you can never run that fast, so I've decided that I like who I am, and I won't be running never again. No, I got no ticket, cause wherever I am is home. No, I got no ticket, cause wherever I am is home.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. During the Monday show, my Rethink the Week, I actually started with an article that I had read at the Christian Science Monitor, and it was about an election in Belarus. I didn't even know there was an election going on in Belarus. I had to go to my map to make sure I remembered exactly where Belarus was. But it was talking about this woman who is running for president against Alexander Lukashenko, a former English teacher. Her husband is in prison. And she basically talked about the fact that if now is not the time, we have to sort of get beyond the fear. And she talked a lot about fear, but realizing that fear has actually two ways of approaching it. You can either hunker down and run away, or it can inspire you to find change. And as I was looking at this really remarkable heroine, I went, wow, I got to follow this election, which I know will be a phony election. But I need to remind everyone about the kind of challenges we face around the world, because it's not just us that have a Donald Trump. Belarus has Alexander Lukashenko, and he's been around for a really long time. So what do? I find Casey Michael. And Casey Michael writes a piece entitled, Alexander Lukashenko's Belarusian Dictatorship is Going Down in Flames. And I'm thinking, have you seen the rest of the story? Anyway, the former Soviet Republic has exploded into unrest after its most recent sham election, and there may be no going back. So let me welcome to the program Casey Michael. We have never met. You are a great writer. It was a phenomenal piece. And what I said to you before you came on the air is, one, I'd like you to introduce yourself to my audience so they understand your area of expertise. And then I want you to sort of explain a little bit of the history of Belarus, which is what you do very effectively in your article. Because as I said, we know nothing about the Soviet Union. We know nothing about current Russia. We don't know what happened really after the fall of the Soviet Union, because this is a nation that is just incredibly xenophobic. We focus on ourselves. We don't educate ourselves in the world. I wish we had the BBC here, but we don't. We have CNN. And actually, CNN here is actually better in Europe than it is here, which is another great disappointment. People don't even know that. It's a very different CNN over in the EU than the CNN we hear. But I want to talk about this faux sham election, because as I was reading your piece, Casey, I felt I was reading a piece about America. I felt I was reading a piece about Donald Trump. And I want people to understand the parallels. This guy may have been around for a long time, but that doesn't matter because the similarities are striking and frightening. So with that, let me welcome you to the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Arnie. Thank you so much for the kind words and your readership. And it's great to finally get the chance to meet and appear on your show. Just a little bit about myself. I am a writer and a journalist based in New York. My primary focus is in the post-Soviet space. I had the great honor of being a Peace Corps volunteer about a decade ago in Kazakhstan, which was my initial entree and entry into the post-Soviet space. And it was something that took ever since. I got a master's degree in Russian post-Soviet studies, and I've been writing on the region ever since for the past 5, 6, 7 years. And I never quite expected that post-Soviet studies to be as relevant in the U.S. as they have been over the last 2 years. That's certainly the way the world is working these days. As you mentioned, there was an election, a sham election, in Belarus last Sunday, just to catch everybody up to speed. Exactly as you mentioned, Arnie, it was an election in name only. This is not something that anybody anywhere in the world thought was free and fair. The gentleman who declared himself the victor in the election is a man named Alexander Lukashenko, who just so happens to be the same man who has won every election in Belarus since 1994. So just a little bit of history about Belarus for those who may not be familiar with it, who may not know where it is on a map. Belarus is one of the 15 former Soviet republics. It is located firmly in Eastern Europe, right between Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine, and Russia. It's a pretty well-sized country. It's not that small. It's maybe the size of a Poland or of a France. So its geographic scope, it's pretty large. But it is one of those countries that is so often overlooked, not only because it exists in this kind of broader Eastern European shifting borders area, not only because it is a former Soviet country that only declared independence in 1991, but also because of the political realities in the country. That is to say, this is a country that has been dominated by one man and one man alone for almost 30 years, for almost the entirety of Belarus's independent existence. Alexander Lukashenko is a brute, he is a thug, he is a tyrant, and he is a dictator. And he's often referred to as the last dictator in Europe. Now, that's not quite accurate anymore. We have Putin in Russia. We have a number of other forces in places like Azerbaijan. We have nascent dictators in potential future dictators in places like Hungary. He is the model, though, that so many others, Putin himself, have followed over the last 20, 25, 30 years now.
So what I want you to do is I want you to introduce my audience to Alexander as he got elected in 1994. I want you to hear the description of who he was, what people perceived he was, assumptions people made about Alexander, and how wrong those assumptions were, because now in 2020, with the sham election, there has only been one president. It is Alexander Lukashenko. what they got in 1994 is what they thought, ah, no big deal. You know, this guy's not going to last, whatever. But I want you to describe who he was, because his biography and the expectations people had are important, because in a lot of ways it is very Donald Trumpish in how you describe him. It may not be the gilded hotels and it may not be the wealth, but the personality traits are very, very similar.
You're exactly right, Arnie. So I think it's worth going back to the very late Soviet period. In 1989, 1990, 1991, you have the communist system in the Soviet Union collapsing. You have economic morass. You have economic massive recession. You have incredible frustration from individual Soviet citizens, to say nothing of their Eastern European satellites, but the Soviet citizens who really overthrew that regime. In places like Ukraine, in places like Belarus, in places like Russia, in places like the Baltic states, that is Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, rising up, throwing off the reins of this one-party system that had become so corrupt, so brutal, and so repressive that there was nothing you could do but push back against that. You have the Soviet collapse in 1991, and then you don't really know what to expect following that. In places like Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, you had a scramble between the nationalists, the economic reformers, the kind of proto-Soviets that didn't really want the system to collapse, all coming together, all butting heads in a way and in an open manner that the country in that region had really never seen in years and years and decades, frankly, at that point. Now, in Belarus, you had a couple of different competing political factions vying for power. You had the kind of communist holdovers, you had the economic reformers, you had the nationalists, and you had this guy named Alexander Lukashenko, who in 1991, 1992 made a name for himself in highlighting what he thought accurately at the time was the overwhelming corruption of the ruling class, of the elites, of the people that had been brutalizing Belarusians for years and years. And that is how he initially caught fire. He was kind of a nobody at the time. He was a collective farmer. He worked on a pig farm in a small area of Belarus. He didn't come from the nomenklatura. He wasn't an intellectual. He was somebody who just railed against the corruption or the perceived corruption of the elites. A couple years go by, there isn't really any stability, and a couple of the operatives, the PR and media and political operatives in the country, realize, you know, that Lukashenko guy, he was interesting. Maybe we could get him to come back. So 1994 rolls around, and there's a presidential election, and you have these political operatives, these kind of political technologists saying, maybe we could float Alexander Lukashenko as a candidate. What do you think about that? I want to read this quote from a scholar named Andrew Wilson, who wrote a great book. It's just called Belarus. It's about the country. Anyone wants to learn about it, highly recommend it. He said, there were others who waited in the wings, that kind of the, you know, the powers that be, the people pulling the strings. And he said, they were confident they could manipulate Lukashenko in their own interests and steer their own craft in his wake. That is to say, they put him forward. They thought he'd be kind of an empty suit, somebody they could manipulate. He's just a pig farmer, after all. What does he know? They could pull the strings. They could be the ones that would help, as they said, destroy the old machine of executive power and take power in their own hands. Now, that didn't quite work out, as we've seen over the last almost 30 years now with Lukashenko in power. And there's one other quote I want to read from one of these people that pushed Lukashenko to power, looking back in hindsight. And this was one of his media people that helped craft this image of this, you know, anti-elite, anti-corruption crusader, man of the people that they thought they would make him be. This is the quote. It was clear that Lukashenko thirsted for power. Like a 16-year-old youth wants intimacy with a woman, so Lukashenko, with every fiber of his spirit, every cell of his organism, desired power as such.
Oh my God, that's Donald Trump. I just think about that. That's Donald. I read that sentence. I read the sentence in your article, and I wrote all over it. Trump, he's a 16-year-old. He's yearning for this great sex, and the sex is called power. That's what it is, you know? It's unbelievable. I saw that, and it was Donald Trump. It's an amazing, amazing quote.
No, you're exactly right, Arnie. This is Trump. This is Lukashenko. This is a range of other figures, largely within the post-Soviet space that I'm familiar with, but by no means only. This is a typology of a man who is taken for granted or viewed as a fool or viewed as somebody who is an empty suit that the powers can be, can then pull their strings, easily manipulable, easy to laugh at, and easy to control moving forward. And time and time and time again, that thesis, that idea, that notion falls apart as soon as that figure is in power. And I think this Andrew Wilson scholar that I cited, who again wrote this wonderful book called Belarus, he has another quote that I cited in the piece, which is, I think, keeping in mind within the Trumpian framework. In Belarus, if somebody other than Lukashenko had won that first presidential election, Belarus would most likely have become a reasonably well-functioning semi-presidential system. Maybe not a full-functioning democracy like we see in places like Canada or places, certain European jurisdictions, but something that was moving slowly in fits and starts toward a more democratic future. Instead, what happened is you had that one man, Lukashenko, in power, and everything stopped and everything rolled back. And it has been a one-man dictatorship for 25, 26 years now.
So let me just say something. So I'm reading your article, but the difference between Alexander and Donald Trump is that Alexander came at the beginning of formation of this new Belarus. So there wasn't a history. There wasn't the same kind of, everyone had this expectation that the system would survive, that the checks and balances would work, that, you know, elections have consequences, but we can always unelect him. You know, that somehow the system would hold. So I can sort of understand Alexander's ability to want power, to succeed at power, because he really created the system because there wasn't a system before. So he was both the mastermind and the power-hungry leader. What is so shocking about Donald Trump is that supposedly we believed in this sort of these institutions of government, these checks and balances, that the party would not allow him to go into such an authoritarian place. And yet, in America, where we had, you know, so many years of history and this understanding, and look at how we have failed. That is terrifying. I don't give Belarus a pass, but I understand how it happened. I am looking at us and going, God help us, a pox on us, because we were not able to withstand this, which means how much had we hollowed out the system, Casey? See, that's the thing. We think we have the system in place. What we don't know is how that system has been hollowed out over the years. You may think there's a law, you may think there's a regulation, you may think there's an expectation, but given what we've done, especially in the last 50 years, is we have really drained it of its vitality and its ability to be enforced.
Yes, you're exactly right, Arnie. And that is for so many diffuse and diverse and divergent reasons that obviously I'm sure the listeners are fully aware of. We don't need to go into details now. I will say there is one fascinating area that I have been taken with over the last, 4 or 5 years, as we've seen this rise in Trump and as we've seen these certain domestic developments in other post-Soviet states elsewhere. And that is examining or re-examining Jim Crow era state structures, governing structures, not necessarily on the national scale, but on the state level scale. So state, Jim Crow Georgia, Jim Crow North Carolina, Jim Crow Florida, looking at the manifestations of how power was centralized, controlled, how it manifested itself, how it related to press coverage, how it related to state level institutions. And then what we are seeing and have seen take place in these post-Soviet dictatorships over the last 20, 30 years, because the parallels are perhaps unsurprisingly very strong in terms of power centralization, in terms of brutalization, in terms of lack of freedom and manipulation of the press, and in terms of an unwillingness to confront these democratic demands from the bottom up. Now, obviously, that was targeted at Black Americans in the U.S., and obviously, it's targeted at other populations in the post-Soviet states. But these models, these typologies, and then when you have figures like Lukashenko and Trump come to the fore as increasing or extending that model into the future, it's so unfortunate and on the one hand and so unsurprising on the other that there are so many parallels that exist. Now, the good news within that is that there are democratization models that also exist, experiences, stories, and logistical strategies that we saw take firm root in the civil rights movement in the U.S. in the 1960s, and that we've also begun seeing take root in countries like Belarus. Here we are in 2020. It's an absolute shame this is in the 21st century, but here we are. So there are lessons to be learned. There are models that we can actually look to for success, and there are reasons, however few, however scant there may be right now, for optimism moving forward.
Let me use the pandemic as an opportunity, because I want people to hear how Alexander addressed the pandemic in Belarus, because the similarity between Alexander and the pandemic is shocking with what Donald Trump has done with the pandemic. And this is important, because this is where people want to live. In the end, people want to live. They can drink the Kool-Aid for so long. They can believe them. But eventually, you know, vodka is not going to work any more than hydroxychloroquine, whatever that stupid thing is, or it's not going to eventually disappear. And explain to my audience how Lukashenko addressed the pandemic, because the similarities between what he did and what Trump did is shocking in a lot of ways. But it also gives me hope that the pandemic, where it is frightening and it's killing, and we've elected these sort of master murderers, frankly, is what I'm considering them. But that is also an opportunity to bring people together, because the pandemic doesn't ask what part of the country you live in. The pandemic doesn't ask what party you are. It doesn't ask what color you are. It is lethal and it is brutal to all of us. And when you have leaders that are basically helping the coronavirus, not fighting it, but helping it, that gives an opportunity to say, this leader needs to change.
Yeah, Arnie, you're exactly right. I'm very happy. I wasn't sure we were going to talk about the response to coronavirus today, but boy, if there is any humor to be found within this, however incredibly dark it is, that's within the response to coronavirus. So to catch everyone up to speed, Lukashenko, like many dictators before him, and I'm sure who will come after, is cocooned in this web of fantasy. He is cocooned in this idea that, oh, nothing can topple him, and any potential threat, something like coronavirus, clearly is manufactured just to take him down. And I know I don't have to say this, but certainly we've seen that time and again from our own president here in the U.S. But Lukashenko, he said coronavirus is a hoax. He said it is a psychosis. And even if anybody gets it, there's one remedy, there's one thing that they can do to make sure that they are safe, and that is drink some vodka and sit in a sauna. That is the solution for everything. But if you're feeling down, if you have a hangover, it's a hair of the dog, or if you have this thing called coronavirus, which, by the way, doesn't even exist, just have some vodka, sit in a sauna. Now, the great irony within that, well, maybe there are two ironies. On the first hand, Lukashenko caught the disease. He actually contracted coronavirus. Now, he's recovered. He is okay. And obviously, I don't wish ill on anyone, but he is recovered, but he did end up catching it. And that's one.
So he didn't become like Boris Johnson and have like a bedside conversion. I mean, Boris Johnson was like blown away when he almost died. And you really saw him. And it was, and there are two immigrants that were taking care of him. And you saw Boris Johnson going, oh my God, the national health system is so important. So unfortunately, Alexander Lukashenko got COVID-19, but he didn't have that same kind of conversion.
No, I think the ship for him, for Lukashenko, and for Trump both has sailed quite a bit ago for any kind of conversion, any kind of come to Jesus moment or realization for shifting policies. Not at all. And especially now, because the timing of coronavirus just so happened to coincide with an upcoming election in Belarus, which these people, this entire post-Soviet generation that has known, you know, people born in the late 80s through the 1990s, they know nothing but Alexander Lukashenko and his rule and his brutality. All of a sudden, they're dealing with an unprecedented recession. You know, the economic slump in Belarus is incredible, and they are dealing with a leader that doesn't think coronavirus exists. Or if it does, all you need to do is drink some vodka, sit in a sauna, don't wear a mask. These two realities collided in perfect timing, frankly, to see this upsurge, this upswell in protests, the likes of which we have never seen in Belarus. And this was this vote that we saw on Sunday with Lukashenko coming out and saying he won 80% of the vote, which is just an insane tally. Maybe he won 10%, maybe he won 20% tops. There's no way in hell he won 80%. But this is why the last 2-3 days have been so remarkable to see in Belarus. People standing up, people marching, people protesting, people confronting the riot police, people in some cases beginning to die now for their beliefs that Belarus deserves a different leader, a different model, and a more democratic, more Western-leaning future.
Oh, Casey Michael, you're a great talker and a great writer. The title of the piece, Alexander Lukashenko's Belarusian Dictatorship is Going Down in Flames. God, I pray so. The former Soviet Republic has exploded into unrest after its most recent sham election, and there may be no going back. I hope so for Belarus. I hope so for the world. The other thing that I also thought was interesting, and I just want to remind everyone, that like a lot of these satellites, they're dependent on Russia. And Russia was able to sort of keep them afloat because they had significant oil and gas revenues. What we have seen is the crashing of the oil and gas revenues, which is basically the only thing that Russia produces. And as a result, that now has another sort of impact on Alexander Lukashenko, because if there was a government teat to suck on, it was Putin's, and that was really holding up the economy. So you've got not only the economic failure from a pandemic, You've got the pandemic. You've got not enough vodka and saunas available to everyone to sort of keep them safe. But then you've got the collapse of the oil and gas industry with Putin. And you really are seeing not even a trifecta, but a quadfecta of problems. So as I let you go, you said there may be no going back. Svetlana, how do you pronounce her last name?
Tikhanovskaya. Yeah, it's a long last name.
Okay, I won't pronounce it.
Svetlana. But
Right. Svetlana has fled. She's gone to Lithuania, my understanding is. So she has fled because she fears for her children. But you do see that enough people, you think there's a critical mass. Is this a tipping point for Belarus? And is that what you're predicting?
This is a tipping point in multiple senses. On the one hand, you have a figure like Svetlana that Belarus has really never seen before, not only because she is this bright, this well-spoken, this incredibly telegenic female figure as a political figure, who has now, as you mentioned, been forced to flee to Lithuania, but also because we've never seen this critical number of protesters out on the street. Again, in the middle of a pandemic, these people are taking these risks to their own personal health, not only because of the disease, but also because of the brutal figures that are the riot police, the state police, the military, coming down and hammering them. Now, the question that I have, and everyone is in the next week is going to have, is will this week be enough? Will there be enough people on the street? Will we have 5% or 10% or more of the population that is willing, that really, as we've seen in previous overthrow models, really you have to get to that critical mass, that critical number before the elite begin fracturing and turning on Lukashenko. And this week is going to be critical for that, absolutely critical for that. I don't know if that will happen, but so
what's our reaction? What has been the U.S.'s reaction to what just happened in Belarus? I mean, I'm sure it's crickets, but I have to ask because historically we would weigh in on things like this. Yeah. We would sort of exercise some sort of leadership here. Obviously, no, we now know, especially because it is a tool of Putin. We know what Donald Trump's instincts are, that, to blame Svetlana and to sort of praise Alexander. But I'm sort of curious, have you heard anything from the United States government?
Yeah, I don't think our listeners need to concern themselves. No, Donald Trump hasn't said a single thing about Belarus. He hasn't said a single thing about these pro-democracy protesters, let alone about Svetlana. You know, the U.S.'s response was slow and it was perfunctory. It came from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. There have been a number of other congressional officials that have issued their own statements, but it's been one of those kind of mealy-mouthed, you know, respect the protesters, respect democracy, but the U.S. isn't going to do anything about it under this administration. The U.S. under this administration has actually been pushing for a thought in relations with Belarus over the last few years. They are just this year returning an ambassador to the country, even in the midst of this now middle of this third decade of this dictatorship. The Trump administration decides now is as good a time as any to go forward and try to repair relations with Belarus. That might change after this. I don't know. We'll have to see. But it has been, as with so many other things, greatly disappointing to see how the U.S. has approached this reality in Belarus.
So obviously, I'm lighting candles and I'm got my fingers crossed and I'm saying my prayers, which they don't actually ever do. But I'm thinking, so has the EU issued anything in the way of support for what's happening in Belarus? Are we seeing, I mean, who's filling this leadership void? I mean, China's seeing this opportunity, but right now they're not going to focus on Belarus. They're going to focus on everything else. The EU, however, has to sort of look at this because this is their backyard. This is important for them because they're not only facing the pandemic, they also have an economic downturn. There is a lot of concern about what's happening with Russia because of Donald Trump's relationship in NATO and the whole dog and pony show. So I'm kind of curious, what have we heard from the EU? Have we heard anything in the way of support, or are they just sitting on the sidelines and watching to see what the people of Belarus do before they sort of offer any kind of support? Because if there isn't enough critical mass to sort of move forward on Alexander, why would they weigh in?
Yeah, no, the EU has already begun issuing strong statements of condemnation against Lukashenko, against his brutality. They're already beginning to discuss further rounds of sanctions against Lukashenko and his enablers and his elite, which is something we haven't seen in the U.S. yet. And they are providing in Lithuania shelter for Svetlana, and I have no doubt that that kind of outflow, if it continues, will find a firm, stable, and welcoming home in the EU. Again, the EU can only do so much as it pertains. There's no military power within the EU. No. Obviously, everything is NATO or NATO related to that. Now, the interesting thing that I've seen is it's less the EU taking a leadership role in this than it is the actual governments in Poland and Lithuania. And Poland, we don't have time to discuss, has also seen its this horrific authoritarian backsliding in the last 2, 3, 4 years, which makes this actual leadership role that much more surprising. The Poles and the Lithuanians have really taken a vocal lead on this, trying to organize some kind of summit or in-person discussion with Lukashenko and the opposition to try to barter some kind of deal moving forward. Because at the end of the day, what everyone wants is to avoid the bloodshed that I think a lot of us expect to come the longer Lukashenko remains in power. We'll see what happens, but it is a concerning
Casey, story. I need to let you go. Casey Michael, he's writing for the New Republic. He's based in New York. His knowledge of the area is important. Make sure a question gets asked of Joe Biden about this.
Yes, he's already issued a great statement.
Okay. Good. We're calling you back. I promise. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Casey Michael writes for the New Republic. Alexander Lukashenko's Belarusian dictatorship is going down in flames. Oh, my God, I can see the flames now. Anyway, thank you so much. Ciao, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.